Well, good evening, everyone. And first, let me say thank you so much for that very, very warm introduction. I want to say to all of you how thrilled I am. Beth, thank you, and the World Affairs Councils of San Antonio. This is my first visit to San Antonio. It's not my first visit to Texas, but my first visit here, and I have to say that it's just a wonderful place. I was very anxious to come, and I'll tell you, my tour today, I certainly was not disappointed. So just thank you, thank you, thank you. You know, in addressing this topic tonight of looking at Russia, Russia's goals, intentions, you know, you have to think about the whole issue that of the Cold War, the time that the Cold War has passed. And I worked in the Reagan administration. And those of you who remember Ronald Reagan always had such great humor. And with the end of the Cold War, there was a story that he was telling, because it was a time of entrepreneurship, of people going forth, and lots of change taking place throughout Central Eastern Europe. Well, there's the story of Maria. Maria bought her own store. As you may recall, you know, at that time, very difficult, property owned by the state, so she had her own store. So her dear friend István in Budapest decided to get her this beautiful bouquet of flowers because she was going to have a celebration. So he sent it to her store, and he showed up later. And when he came in, he was horrified. He was truly horrified because on the bouquet of flowers, it said, "Rest in peace." So he was upset and he said, "I'm not going to let this stand, Maria. I'm going to run down the street to the florist and I'm going to tell him a thing or two." So we did. And he went to the florist. He said, "How embarrassing, my dear friend Maria. She has her new store and I can't believe this bouquet with rest in peace." And the florist got a hold of him and he said, look, my dear friend István, you're not looking at this properly. You don't have a sense of perspective here. Look at it this way. Someone was buried today with a big bouquet of flowers that said, congratulations, good luck in your new location." So, anyhow, but, you know, seriously, what we are facing in this post-Cold War period, when you step back and you look at all of the challenges we face, it's a time of great peril, but it's also a time of great promise. And one of the issues that certainly is confronting us, and us meaning not just the United States, but the West, is the issue of where Russia is going and what's happening in Russia and the invasion that and the aggression that Russia has taken upon Ukraine. But let me step back and say first a few words about Russia itself. When you look at Russia, where is Russia today? Russia is, in terms of its economy, it has the sixth largest economy in the world. But I think significantly, Russia has not modernized itself. For those of you who follow this, Russia depends rather extensively on its energy resources, but it hasn't modernized and diversified its economy and how it grows its economy. Secondly, and also I think importantly here, is the fact that Russia is the top energy producer, global producer. And it is looking at alternative customers, as we know, because there have been changes that are taking place afoot in Europe today because of what's happening in Ukraine. But not just only because of what's happening in Ukraine. I think, thirdly, it's worth noting that one of the great challenges for Russia is grappling with the issue of human rights. There have been a series over the last years of human rights cases and abuses. The most well-known case of Magnitsky, the death of Magnitsky in prison. But not just only that. There have been a series of journalists who've lost their lives for reporting on various issues. Irina Poloskovskaya, for her reporting on Chechnya a number of years ago, lost her life. And there are others. There's been a clampdown on human rights in the context of the freedom of press. And I say that to you because one of the issues that you hear often is, and you read often, is Putin's popularity. But you have to also keep in mind that the information that's being obtained by the population is very limited, and it's funneled through certain channels. There's a fourth factor I wanted to put forward to you in just stepping back and looking at where Russia is. Russia has significant demographic challenges. If you follow this, it's not only because of an aging population, but it's more and also an influx of immigrants over the years, particularly because of the border with China. And also, when you look at Central Asia, members of the Muslim community that have come into Russia itself. But actually, it's also when you look at the demographics of age and the fact that particularly men in Russia are not living to the same age that you have in most Western countries. Most of them reach a mortality at least by 60. So there are a lot of challenges upon Russia. Let me go to the issue of what happened in Ukraine and how that relates to what we've witnessed from Russia and why and what's exactly taking place politically in this case. And I mentioned the first, by the way, because it's important, my comment about the economy. Because Russia has not grown, and naturally, as you can imagine, when there aren't opportunities for growth, people look for ways of manifesting their concern, their agitation, their irritation. And there have been demonstrations. In fact, a number of years ago, there were demonstrations in Russia, and interestingly enough, the demonstrators were not human rights activists. They happened to be actually mostly members of the middle class, who actually have felt that their opportunities for growing the economy have been stunted and that it is not realizing its full potential. So, with that backdrop, going to Ukraine. In Ukraine, you had in February of 2010 an election which brought in Yanukovych. And Yanukovych beat out Yulia Tymoshenko in the presidential elections that took place. Immediately, or very promptly, upon his election, he went to Brussels and he indicated that he wanted Ukraine to become part of and attached to the EU, in essence, what's known as an EU association. And he stated it very clearly up front, and negotiations and discussions began with the EU in order to have Ukraine become associated. Well, as part of those discussions, naturally, as you can imagine, there are certain standards. If you become affiliated, you have to follow certain standards. One of the challenges for Ukraine, and also, I might add, for Russia, has been that you have oligarchs, you have a pervasive system of also corruption that has permeated different levels of society, which also has impacted a lack of growth and a lack of reform. So in this case, in order for Ukraine to be able to qualify and become associated, the EU put forth a program and a platform saying that, you know, you have to fulfill these standards and undertake these economic reforms. Certainly part of that would be cutting into the kind of pervasive corruption that is existing in Ukraine. So Yanukovych took this on. There were negotiations back and forth. There was also a condition that the EU put forward, and that was to release Yulia Tymoshenko. Remember I mentioned the name? She was the candidate who ran against Yanukovych for president. And upon her losing the election, he had her arrested, and she was put in prison on charges of corruption. There were a number of charges of corruption relevant to her. The EU had said that she was ill and that she had to be released from prison. So this went on for a number of years, and it was coming to the point when there was the deadline date. In November of 2013, when Basically, at that time, there was to be a determination made about Ukraine's association with the EU. You know, interestingly enough, up to this time, there weren't many manifestations emanating from Moscow that there was a concern about this affiliation. But bit by bit, it became more apparent. And actually, at the time, close to the due date, Yanukovych did come out, and partly, part of the reason, but not totally, there was certain arm twisting from Moscow. There were also certain actions taken in terms of their energy supplies, resources that were being cut off or threatened to be cut off vis-a-vis Ukraine. The end result was that Yanukovych decided not to go forward. And quite frankly, I think that not just only was the EU stunned, but actually, I think Ukrainians were quite stunned. There already had been such a momentum and such a feeling about how important this was to be able to become identified with the EU, to undertake these reforms, and to really bring about change and growth in that society, and really to turn a new chapter. Well, as you may recall, there were demonstrations that then ensued on the Maidan. On the Maidan Square, where the Orange Revolution had taken place years before. And these demonstrations were very peaceful demonstrations. The first focus was a declaration about the need for Ukraine to become associated with the EU and to become, you know, integrated with EU and EU standards. But you know what the second part was of the condemnation? It was corruption. And that was because there was a strong feeling with the system of oligarchs, with the kind of lack of transparency, not full rule of law, and a sound foundation of rule of law, that basically Ukraine was not going to be able to advance if this corruption still continued and was pervasive. These demonstrations took place. These were two of the fundamental reasons why they occurred. You may remember that also at this time that there were diplomats who came in because they were very concerned about what was going on and trying to ensure that the situation was addressed and resolved. Because there was also concern that there were troops that came out and they were shooting randomly into the Maidan, and there were some 100 people, approximately about 100 people, who died in the Maidan. They lost their lives demonstrating. So the three who came in was the Polish foreign minister, the French foreign minister, and the German foreign minister. They came in and sat down with Yanukovych and said to him that, look, this has gotten out of hand. There has to be some kind of reconciliation here and a transition. They had an agreement that was signed. The agreement called for elections being held by the end of 2014, that also there would be not only elections held, but also that there would be an investigation undertaken of what happened and the deaths that occurred in the Maidan. And there were several other requirements that were being put forward in order to instill peace and to have a kind of, if you will, peaceful transfer of power. Now, I give you this backdrop because that was the basis of then what happened next. What happened next was Yanukovych disappeared. After he signed that document, he disappeared for several days, and then he surfaced in Moscow. And it was at that time when he surfaced in Moscow that actually then there was first a declaration from Moscow that this was a coup that took place, when, in fact, Yanukovych had agreed to this transition of power, by the way, and in the presence of these diplomats. And then, at the same time, Yanukovych himself made statements calling upon Moscow to use force to contain the situation. Then there was a period where an interim government was set up in Ukraine. And right during that period, in fact, was when there were first reports of appearing in Crimea of what constituted men in green, unidentified uniforms, coming in with guns and, you know, literally dispersing themselves throughout Crimea. Well, what happened next, as we know, there was literally a parliamentary forum held at gunpoint. There was a referendum in Crimea, which was illegal according to the Ukrainian constitution. And then, after Crimea, then there was also not only which took place, but back in Moscow, there was in the Russian parliament, the Duma, a vote that was taken, and that vote basically had codified the legality of the annexation of Crimea to Russia, which was viewed illegally, certainly according to Ukrainian law. And by the way, the invasion itself cut into every legal instrument which not only Russia was part of, but which is part of the framework that we have that has held peace of our international order, not just only Europe, but the international order for literally decades, post not only World War II, but post-Cold War. So what you had then, after this codification, President Putin gave a speech, and I'm going to come back to that in terms of his articulation of the reasons as to why these actions were taken. But then, shortly after that, you then had the invasion of eastern Ukraine. And I use the word invasion because you know the term that's used, that there are separatists, there are insurgents who, in fact, have been paid on the ground in eastern Ukraine. And at the same time, you have Russian troops and also armament, artillery, in eastern Ukraine. And tremendous bloodshed, tremendous strife, tremendous displacement of a population. So, with this backdrop, what does this all mean? What is it that Russia is doing? I'd start with this, and the fact is that you have in Russia what constitutes Putinism. Putinism because it's about Putin. You have vertical power, and you have personal power. I mentioned to you about the importance of the economy and the fact that there hasn't been economic growth and modernization. Russia has relied predominantly on its energy sources, resources. And in that sense, there has been a kind of frustration, and it has manifested itself in a number of demonstrations internally. This action that was taken does have to do with the economy, because that's part of the reason, where is Russia going to go? What are the reforms that are going to be undertaken? Recently, the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, made a statement in Russian press that the Russian economy is going to stagnate at least for 5 years. It's not going to go anywhere unless there are reforms. That doesn't bode well for the direction of Russia. And as you can imagine, although President Putin has a high popularity rating, the question is, given the control of the press and given where the economy is at this time, with things getting worse, will that still remain the same way? So back to what are the reasons and the rationale for what took place here. I would first start with the fact that actually in 2007, President Putin gave a speech at what's known as the Munich Security Conference. He also gave the speech on March 18 before the Duma. Some of the points that were mentioned in each of these speeches are the same. He already had been thinking about certain concepts relevant to Russia, Russia's role in the world today, and the concepts that he wanted to put forward. One, the fact that he had stated unequivocally, Russia has the right to go in anywhere, to protect Russians living abroad. And Russian speakers, but especially ethnic Russians, if they are in jeopardy. One of the allegations happened to be that those Russians, and it is predominantly a Russian population in Crimea in terms of its percentage, that basically that they needed to come in because that Russian population needed help. Now, to say to you, if that's the case, why not call upon the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe? It has a human rights component. Bring in monitors. Have them come in, why would one come in and use force in this case? And by the way, cut out the OSCE monitors. The monitors requested to come in at the time the referendum was held in Crimea, and the referendum on who Crimea would become attached to, and it ended up being Russia, but there were no monitors. So in this case, the first point that he put forward was this one about the protection of the Russian population. The second one was stating that the values of the West are no longer the values of Russia. And in this case, specifically, that, you know, there's a lack of tradition, conservative ideals, that the West has become more decadent in its lifestyle. And he has really spoken to this this particular issue and has literally said, we do not identify with Western values. He also has spoken about Western institutions, that these Western institutions are not the institutions that Russia sees itself with. In fact, he put forward a Eurasian union, economic union, which also has a customs union, and is very desirous of having Ukraine come into that. In fact, he was twisting the arm of Yanukovych, don't go to the EU, come into the Eurasian Economic Union. So specifically, it was also that. Putin has also said quite starkly, you know, one of the greatest tragedies of the last century was the demise of the Soviet Union. And some have speculated his interest in recreating that sphere through this economic union. So I think you have a number of factors here. One is the challenge of the economics at home, and that domestic politics have had an impact on some of the decisions and opportunities which he seized upon. Secondly, I would say that he also has laid down a marker, and the marker being that, in this case, the institutions that we know post-World War II that have, and post-Cold War, that have preserved peace and stability, that they no longer are the ones that are going to maintain law and the legal order that we, and the framework of peace that we know, meaning NATO, the European Union, even the United Nations in a certain context. And then thirdly, I would also say that these actions also, it's not just what he's saying, but the actions taken by the illegal annexation of Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, it also does something else that's very serious. And that is, and it only doesn't relate to just Ukraine, but beyond. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. You may recall that Ukraine actually had a very sizable nuclear arsenal. It gave it up through what was called the Budapest Memorandum, which the United States, UK, Russia, and Ukraine had all agreed to in 1994. In return for giving up its nuclear weapons, what happened was that Ukraine said, I will give up our nuclear weapons in turn for protection of our territorial integrity and sovereignty. So these actions undercut the very essence of that memorandum. In turn, it does something else. Think about other issues that are taking place that are in the news these days. Of course, Iran. Iran is looking at its own nuclear issues, looking at the negotiations taking place. By the way, in this case, when you see a memorandum that basically was undercut and it wasn't upheld, you have to question, what does that? What kind of signal does that send to Iran? What kind of signal does that send to North Korea? And also, what kind of signal does that send for those who support non-proliferation efforts? So why I present this to you is because it has ramifications not just for Ukraine and for the region, but also globally. It's important for the region, but also it's important globally. Even the assertion about protection of Russian nationals, it also has a relevance to other parts of the world. China, right now, the disputes, the island disputes, the types of issues that exist there, there are analogies you can make. When I read Asian press, particularly Japanese press, in the aftermath of the not only the illegal annexation of Crimea, but the invasion of eastern Ukraine, you know what was being mentioned in Japanese press over and over was the question about extended deterrence. What do our alliances in this day and age mean? And can we count on that kind of deterrence still undergirding our own safety and protection? So, here, stepping back, I think what we have is, I use the term Putinism, and with regard to Putinism, you're talking about a consolidation of power here, you're talking about a rejection of the framework that has held the peace, and a rewriting, literally, of that, and also a destabilization not only of what's happening in Ukraine, but even more globally. And one more piece with that, and that is, I think what we also see is that Russia is not desirous of seeing Ukraine succeed economically and have benefits for itself. That will pose a problem for Russia, clearly in terms of its own domestic situation, and also, not only that, but also there's the issue of what will it mean for the Russian population and literally a people fleeing, as they say, a brain drain and leaving the country. Let me come to the last piece and close, because I really want to spend more time hearing your questions before me, to hear what you have uppermost in your mind. In terms of what Russia did and the policies that are put forth, it's important to look at what is it that the West decided to go forward with. First, economic sanctions. The economic sanctions that were put into place were incremental. My own view is I don't think I would have gone for an incremental approach. And the reason why I wouldn't have gone for an incremental approach, because naturally if you do that, you're not sending a strong signal that you're very concerned about what already had taken place. In other words, it's somewhat dubious in terms of sending the clear signal that this is wrong, we will not stand for this. But there is a challenge here on economic sanctions, and you know the challenge is that countries in Europe have significant trade with Russia, not only in the energy sector, but in many sectors. So how do you offset economic ties, concerns about domestic issues, with being able to send a strong signal? It's not easy, but unity matters. And right now, Europe rallied around and the United States on economic sanctions. These sanctions will be reviewed at the end of June. And the question will be whether or not they stay in place, whether they get enhanced, or whether they change. And it remains to be seen what will unfold. Secondly, there's been a heavy debate over the issue of military assistance. Ukraine itself has made a strong appeal for military assistance from the West. Not just training. Training is being given, but military assistance. And the reason for it is, they argue, let us defend ourselves. We're not asking for troops from you, but we are asking for military hardware. Because with the last regime, we were ended up being bankrupt. Yanukovych, you may have seen, splashed across the news, his mansion, and also the fact when they opened up the bank that, you know, billions of dollars were gone. So in this case, the military is emasculated, and they've asked for military support. In this case, the argument in favor of it is it sends a signal, and it will help them defend themselves. The argument that has made by others against it is it could lead to an escalation. And so toward that end, no, let's not. I am on the side of giving them the assistance. I think that if they made the choice, which they have, to go ahead and to do this, then we should provide that assistance for them. If they cannot stand up and be helped to fight for themselves. Thirdly, there's an information warfare here that's also going on, in terms of the amount of propaganda and literally about what's happening on the ground there and what's not happening on the ground. One issue that certainly was splashed across the news was the death of Boris Nemtsov. You know, he died in the Kremlin Square, and he died at gunpoint. It's not easy to have a gun accessible, so he died right at gunpoint. Someone came up, shot him. You know, today there was, in fact, someone who worked with him who did a documentary. The documentary literally goes into the, in specifics, the Russian involvement in eastern Ukraine, in specifics, in terms of numbers, photos, everything. Why does this matter? Because inside Russia, the information that has been rendered is that we're not involved there. We don't have any troops in there. There's a problem because, as you may recall from Afghanistan and the deaths of then Soviet troops, and Russians in particular, that there's a concern about the public opinion. And, you know, when there was a public opinion poll of Russians about a war in Ukraine, 70% said they don't want to have their sons involved in a war in Ukraine. So this information also matters, and that's an area that I think that we need to do much more in terms of getting information out and combating the kinds of disinformation. And then fourthly and finally, I was very impressed. I met recently with four Ukrainian women parliamentarians, very impressive. They came to Washington, D.C., and they didn't want to make the same appeal that some other Ukrainian politicians have made, meaning about economic assistance for Ukraine, or the military assistance, or sanctions, or even the information of warfare. But they made an appeal for humanitarian aid. And the reason being is because you have a substantial number of families that are dislocated and you're literally detached from their homes because of this conflict and because of this aggression in eastern Ukraine. What's happening is very tragic and shouldn't be happening in this day and age and at this time. So let me say in conclusion, what we are witnessing, I think, is a very serious situation. It's one in which, in my view, if there are not strong signals and a strong stance taken here, that I don't think that the situation, that it's going to cease. Already in Mariupol, which is the seaport town that really matters in terms of a bridge, by the way, down to Crimea, a land bridge into the whole water port area. But basically, here what you have is a situation that they already had a provocation and a number of deaths there in Mariupol. But not only there, there have been provocations in the Baltic states and elsewhere. The question is, what will happen next? I would say that it cannot be ruled out at all, and I do think that it's very, very important and very crucial for the West not only to remain united around the values and institutions that we hold so dearly, they're being challenged, they're being attacked, but also at the same time to look at ways forward, like getting Ukraine on its feet economically and literally supporting them toward that end. Those are the kinds of steps that I think are meaningful. And what happens there, I'll say again, is not only affecting Ukraine, but it will affect Europe more broadly. And that's because of this aggression emanating from Moscow. Let me stop there and say I really look very much forward to your questions, your comments, and a give and take on issues. And also, I'll ask you to identify yourself. So thank you.
Oh, my name is Robert Shivers. Maybe one of the few people in the room who's been in the Ukraine. And when we were there, our young guides, one pro-Russian, two pro-Ukraine, sort of agreed that everything east of the Dnieper River was pro-Russian and everything west of the Dnieper River was pro-Western. Is it not a fact that the Crimea was part of Imperial Russia for 1,000 years or more, and only became part of Ukraine during when it was part of the Soviet Union. I think Khrushchev is the one that said, okay, you go ahead and take it. But of course, that was a country then, and it didn't seem to be a problem. I think when we were in Sevastopol, a lot of buildings there had the Russian flag. I think the Russian Navy there was larger than the Ukraine Navy. And so doesn't Russia claim the Crimea more for historical reasons than maybe for political reasons?
Thank you for your question. And let me, by the way, I wanted to ask, when were you there? You said you were there? Okay, that's right. You had told me that beforehand. Good question, and let me answer parts of it. First, I want to start with the broader part and then come to Crimea. The broad part, it's important to know that when Ukraine got its independence, that, by the way, there was a referendum. And the referendum also included Crimea, by the way. So just to start with that. And also, let me even backtrack. There was, when Ukraine got its independence, there was actually a National Intelligence Council report that said that within 10 years that Ukraine was going to split east and west. It never did, by the way. Secondly, there's not one, and I would challenge you on this, secessionist movement that I'm aware of in Ukraine. There might be Russian speakers, and there certainly are 17% of the Russian 17% of the Ukrainian population is Russian. And maybe there might be family and a bent this way, that way. But the fact is, there's never been any secessionist movement in Ukraine. Thirdly is, yes, it is also true when you look at the referendum. By the way, the majority of those on and in Ukraine basically went and supported independence. I believe the figure was something close to 80-90% in Crimea when that referendum took place and said, do you support being part of Ukraine? It was about 55% in that case. But they did go for Ukrainian independence. Also, one other data point I want to mention with regard to Crimea that's important. Ukraine, just before all of this happened, renegotiated the basing rights some 25 years. There's never been a single incident that I'm aware of between Ukrainians and Russians in Crimea that I'm aware of. I don't know of any incident, including with the militaries. It's been very respectful, very cordial. You are right, it was Khrushchev was the one who, that's correct, it was during Khrushchev's time who said, here, you know, Crimea is part of Ukraine. But by the way, remember what that period was. It was all part of the Soviet Union. So also, think about it, it was also viewed as a whole. You're all united together in this case. I'd also remind in this case that, you know, it's worth my mentioning this. When you look back historically at statements made, Lenin made the statement that if Russia loses Ukraine, or if we lose Ukraine, I think those were the precise words, if we lose Ukraine, we lose our head. So there are these views and sentiments. This is true. But also that doesn't negate how the people have been living on the ground. And that's what I would counter here, is that they have been living amicably, despite certain forecasts by our own National Intelligence Council, by others. You know, it's an area that, you know, again, it comes back to the point about disinformation. And when you look at, really, what does history tell us? So that's why I would counter these points fundamentally with no secessionist movement, looking at the actual referendum, when it was a free and fair referendum, and what was the outcome, and the fact that you've had a basing agreement that has been very amicable and has not produced strife. This was manifested, this was triggered, this violence, and it's very tragic what has happened. As I said, not only has ramifications for Ukraine, but even more globally for other areas, watching how this area gets handled.
Yes, hi. Sir.
Hi.
My question is, how much involvement is Russia with China building the Canal in Nicaragua, which is in our the U.S. Hemisphere of the world. China is building a Panama Canal in Nicaragua, where I think it's 80% Chinese architect, and they're employing about 20% of Nicaraguans to build. And the rumor is that Russia is also economically supporting China to build this canal.
I have to say, quite honestly, I'm not, I don't know that. I'm not aware of that. I had not heard that. But if you don't mind, I am going to make two comments on your question. Russia did conclude a deal that had been out there for quite some time with China, an energy deal, where basically the deal is that they would give to China gas resources, and in return, actually, for access to Chinese minerals. And specifically, you also have a deal that was concluded recently with North Korea. There, Russia said it would build a railway, and in return for also access to some of the resources within North Korea. So the front part of your question about the engagement, Russia also has a policy, which it has stated, which is a look east policy, where they are looking for interlocutors on energy resources and also for dealing with trade opportunities. So China and North Korea being two of those in this case. In the question you asked me, though, I'm sorry, sir, I'm not aware of that.
And the U.S., what is their comment with that building of that Panama, of that Nicaraguan canal?
As I just said, I said to you all parts of your question relevant to Central America and Panama. Sorry.
All right, thank you.
And thank you for your question. Yes.
Hi, I'm Jade Kachuk, VP of Digital at Security Service FCU here from Odessa, Ukraine, from Southern Region. So if you have any questions, ask me later. But I do agree with you on the...
Did everybody hear that?
No,
because
right.
You said it louder. You said it too rapidly. Say it slowly,
sure.
So everyone hears. Who you
Hi. My name is Jade Kachuk. I'm the VP of Digital at the large credit union here. I do agree with you on the arms supply. And
he's from Ukraine.
Support. I am from Ukraine.
He's from
Southern Ukraine,
Ukraine
okay.
Yes. Right.
However, my question is, the rub is that Russia is not strong. Russia is weak. And if you slap it hard enough, it'll collapse into a dozen nuclear Afghanistans, the large stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons to boot. Do you have any thoughts on containment of all that stuff, if that happens?
Wait, containment of?
Of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons stockpiled all over Russian territory.
I would say this to you in terms of what Russia has. In fact, when I mentioned the details I mentioned at the beginning, let me add, and thank you for your question, Russia is it has nuclear weapons. And in fact, as you know, President Putin often refers to the fact that Russia does have nuclear weapons. And also, by the way, a number of the nuclear weapons that were taken out of Ukraine, when you look at where they went, many of that portion of those nuclear weapons went, in fact, to Russia. In terms of its precise stockpiles and the actual data on what it has and doesn't have, I don't know what the figures are today, but the fact is it is a nuclear weapon. It is a nuclear weapons-based country that definitely, when you're dealing with Russia, you have to take into account in terms of your policies. That's why the United States, and that's why I mentioned, it's striking to me that when we have non-proliferation discussions, and also Russia's part of that, but here when you see what's happened with this aggression in Ukraine, it runs counter to the spirit of what non-proliferation efforts are all about. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but I would just say simply, yes, it's absolutely the case. They do have nuclear weapons, and in that case, the president of Russia often mentions it in his remarks.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Galia Garduño. A question, you began your presentation talking about how undiversified the Russian economy is. that's very oil heavy. So what do you think the probability would be of other similarly undiversified oil heavy economies reaching a similar point of kind of a land grab?
Meaning what kind of ripple effect this could have? I would be concerned. It's not even looking at oil in this case. It's just even the concept of land grab. I'll say that because, as I indicated, certainly when what happened in both Crimea and eastern Ukraine, there are others that are going to be looking in other parts of the world. Hence my comment about the Japanese. Because of the island disputes, you have Japan, you have the Philippines, you have sparring with China over islands, and you also have a military construction around, Chinese military construction around a number of these islands. There's a tension building up. What happens in Ukraine in that sense does, and Russia's actions does, have consequences. If they're not called into account, and you know, in this case, and if they are not ceased and stopped, then basically it does send a signal elsewhere that, look at that, you know, there isn't a kind of legal order and a kind of international order. And they got away with it, well, we can get away with it too. So agreements matter, actions matter, but not just also actions, but backing them up. You know, backing them up and ensuring that the actions that are taken are really going to have consequences. So in my mentioning about economic sanctions, it is going to be a very critical moment at the end of June. There have been, and forgive me, this relates to your question, there have been two negotiations in Minsk, Minsk 1 and Minsk 2, and there have been ceasefires. And those ceasefires have not brought about a ceasefire at all. The strife has still been continuing. So the ramifications of what happens here will be a signal to others. The place that I would look at is not so much, and you mentioned oil producing, but rather more in terms of, like in East Asia, where many countries have been watching very closely what the Chinese have been doing and their actions on and over these islands. That's where I would see some great concerns. Thank you.
Hey.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your history and comments. They've been great. My concern is I really would prefer we didn't escalate with Russia. I think they'd be a way better friend, and I think in some ways we're kind of pushing them towards China. Instead of, I mean, I think they're just a very proud country, and I'm not sure that their actions are so different than what ours might be, like in Cuba or in Mexico, or if we have Americans in Mexico. So, I mean, I kind of feel like maybe we ought to be thinking about, you know, maybe their perspective, and to see if there's some kind of there would be any way to make them a friend. And also, I think that Angela Merkel has been a great lead, the German chancellor, in this, and kind of has a little bit of understanding. I know she was there when they just celebrated their
the 70th anniversary.
70th anniversary, and that they were a friend of ours in World War II. And I just think that, you know, with the Olympics and everything, we've kind of isolated Putin a lot. And there might be a better way. So do you think there would be any possibility for, I mean, I would really prefer, if we ever could, a diplomatic solution to Ukraine versus any kind of a military.
Well, okay. 2 points. Yep. First, let me take the second. On the diplomatic, that's what this Minsk meetings are.
Right.
You have
and
Angela Merkel, you have the French, talking. You have the Russian, and you have the Ukrainian, Poroshenko.
And I'm very hopeful.
By the way, my own view, I would like the United States there diplomatically.
I would
the United
too.
States
I
should be at that table and in that discussion because we have a stake in this. But the United States has not been diplomatically at that. I think that's a mistake, personally. Secondly,
I love what Angela's doing.
Sorry?
I said, I agree. I would love for us to be too. But I really do think maybe this is one that Germany and Merkel might be able to handle
them
better.
I see us as working jointly.
Right.
Because, for example, when Ukraine was challenged in 2004, when there were these illegal elections or fraudulent elections, actually we worked very closely with the EU. The Polish president was in charge, Kwaśniewski, and also the EU president at the time, or Secretary General Javier Solana. Both of them were pivotal players in getting then Ukraine's President Kuchma to bring about new elections. But let me answer your question. First, diplomatically, there are these diplomatic talks, but they're not going anywhere. So that's the first part of your question. That is what Minsk One and Minsk Two is.
Right.
Because those diplomatic exchanges, unfortunately, the ceasefire has not held. And I will tell you, one of the biggest problems of that discussion and that negotiation is the fact of, do you freeze the results of the aggression? In other words, with Crimea, do you have Crimea as it is? For the Baltic states, we had a non-recognition policy. We never recognized the forced incorporation of the Baltic states into the Soviet Union. There are many who say there's the a non-recognition of Crimea. And what about this gray zone in Ukraine, eastern Ukraine? That's the most industrial part of Ukraine. It's the most lucrative part of Ukraine. So in this case, there's a real challenge over diplomacy. The second part, though, I want to take of your question, and I want to make a distinction here. I use the term Putinism, and I mentioned vertical power, personal power in this case. And I would say that, you know, from being in Russia many times, you have very talented people. You have very well, in many parts of Russia, very well-educated people. You have people who, as I've indicated, who want to see Russia grow.
Right.
Boris Nemtsov, when I was listening and to what he had to say about his vision of Russia, and there are many like this, but that is not what's happening in this context. That does not represent all of Russia. But we are dealing with what we are dealing with because Putin is the one who's in the presidency.
Right.
So one has to deal with that situation as it is. And my view is you have to deal with it in a way with strong actions that will bring results. Strong but measured actions. I don't think anyone wants an escalation. I don't think anyone wants that. But I certainly wouldn't also want Ukraine abandoned and where, you know, when they make such a strong appeal for some assistance, military assistance, they're not asking for troops. They're asking to be able to defend themselves. I see great value in that.
And I think when somebody...
Okay. We only have time for one more question, please.
Well, why don't I, because they're both, may I, both, they're both standing there, may I think the two of them? Is that okay?
Okay. Well, we're both Ukrainians.
I'll take both of your questions.
Yes, hello, my name is Olena Kristyuk. I'm Ukrainian, I live in San Antonio. First of all, I want to thank you for the great talk, and I want to thank you for saying that Eastern Ukraine has been invaded. It's not separatist, like Western press continues to say. It's an invasion.
It's part of the disinformation,
yes.
And that's why, forgive me on that, and that's not saying that there aren't, you know, some differences, but it's repeated over and over. That's why I wanted to mention there hasn't been a secessionist movement.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Ukrainians and Russians have lived well together in Ukraine.
So thank you so much, because it was exactly what's not being told in Western press. But the question I do have is that I absolutely agree with you that Putin today is testing the West, testing the Western values, whether our institutions, because I am American these days. It also tests NATO. And as you said, United West is what is going to take Ukraine forward, and that's what's going to destroy Putinism and his power today. My question is, what are, in your mind, the current risks to continued unity, because we've seen in
continued what?
Unity of the West, because we've seen that Putin is definitely working in Europe, where we now have people in Italy, Hungary, Turkey, trying to say, you know, it's not that big of a deal. So the West is kind of falling apart. And if the West falls apart, that's going to be the soft win for Putin, which is just as important as any military win. So thank you.
Let me answer that, if I may, and then we'll take yours. You hit upon a core point, and the core point is that one of the intentions, and I tried to indicate it earlier, of Putin is in fact, to pose a wedge into the West, to impact and bring down the institutional arrangements that have held us together, the values that have bonded us for and have maintained peace and stability for all of our countries. And toward that end, you know, he has impacted a number of areas. You see in terms of a number of center-right, right-of-center parties that have backed Putin in and throughout Europe. Secondly, I think there have been many in Europe who also at times will question. Well, and they question, well, will Ukraine reform itself? And we wonder if Ukraine doesn't reform itself, then why would we get behind this effort? So there's that question as well. He is going for these opportunities. If there's complacency, that provides an opportunity. If there's disunity, that provides an opportunity, definitively. I would say that that is one of the most important things. I mentioned June 30th is certainly going to be the reexamination of the sanctions. If we do not hold that sanctions policy, it will send a signal that this is not important to us. And the rest could be scripted in terms of what will happen therefrom. It definitely opens a wide open door. I think when the men in green uniforms went into Crimea, you know, many people, I was reading in European press, many people thought, oh, it's a one-off, and yes, you know, Khrushchev gave it, and it's kind of a one-off. Mm. And then what happened immediately after the invasion into eastern Ukraine? And right now you hear from other Europeans, certainly the Balts, Poland, you hear from a number of Nordic countries, there have been provocations, military provocations that have been taking place. And these are little signals of the possibility of more to come. So being vigilant, being resolute, being united, you're exactly right in that. It is absolutely essential and critical. He is testing our values. He is testing our institutions. If we do not stand up for what we value, for what we've cared about, for what has maintained the peace, then what do we stand for?
In his mind, that would be a total win.
Thank you very much. And yes.
Thank you again. My name is Tamara. I'm a Ukrainian immigrant, and I'm an army wife. Well, first I wanted to thank you. You know, I don't know how you do it in 30 minutes, and you've been talking since. I mean, in a nutshell, the whole situation is amazing.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I was a little worried if I gave too much detail, so...
I don't know. It's great. It was great. I was watching the news today, and they're talking about NATO drills in Romania, and prior to that was elsewhere in Eastern Europe, in Estonia, and then they had a kind of an after-party in Antalya, Turkey, in a beautiful resort, and NATO... officials, they were talking, well, that Turkey wants to spearhead a 5,000-man NATO force, if need be, and they're talking about the Baltics requesting maybe more NATO presence there.
They have requested. The Baltic countries, and even Poland, not formally, but they have vocalized their desire to have a permanent NATO forward deployment in those countries.
So,
as a deterrent.
It's great. It's wonderful for me to hear, because overall I was looking at the American response, and it's kind of lukewarm, kind of, you know, that we haven't given the hardware and so on. But my question is, are we seeing something new with these NATO drills? Is there going to be a new step in the direction? Is NATO... is willing to help a little more? Because, I mean, let's face it, if you have NATO presence around that area, that is definitely a deterrent. That shows a signal.
Well,
that
exercises, military exercises, basically are a signal of a deterrent and a preparation, a preparedness in the event of an aggression, an additional aggression against a NATO member. All of you know that there's Article 5, that if one NATO country is attacked, that Article 5 kicks in, you come to the collective defense of that country. So particularly you hear from the Baltic states an expression of their concern because there have been a number of provocations. And in Estonia, you have 26% of the population is Russian. In Latvia, it's 27%. It's actually, although these are smaller countries, the percentage is less. In Ukraine, interestingly enough, it's 17%, whereas in these two smaller countries, the percentages of Russians are higher. But the point is, yes, these exercises mobilize, they send a signal, and they also energize that in the event of an attack against a NATO member, that Article 5 kicks in, and then there's the preparedness. And that's an important signal to be sent. But let me add on the two other points. With regard to the forward deployment, there are those in these Baltic countries and in Poland who have urged this, but that has not happened, okay, in terms of a permanent deployment. In fact, it's worth noting, by the way, and contrasting, Gorbachev talked about, by the way, a common European home. Those were his words. They're very different from the words of President Putin. And when he called for a common European home, he asked and said, do not have forward deployed troops on our border. Mm-hmm. So even with NATO expansion, because the issue always is, well, isn't NATO expansion provocative? It was always respected, Russia and Gorbachev's, the terms established, not having forward deployed troops. But there's been an invasion. There's been a threat, and there's a concern that this will happen more broadly. Moldova, Baltic states, Poland,
right.
They're all concerned.
The big Russian population in Moldova, obviously, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it's also very, very important in that sense in sending a signal. But no, it hasn't happened. And on the last, on military as assistance, as I said, there's a big debate in Washington over this. There are people who believe strongly that such assistance should be given. Mm-hmm. There are already a number of European countries that are giving assistance to Ukraine, military assistance. But for the United States, we have not formally done that yet.
Well, we're happy that you're going around the country and bringing awareness to this important issue.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.